Hello, everyone. Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast. I'm here with Ed Horley and Scott Hogue, and we're going to talk about enterprise IPv6 today, or another way to put it, IPv6 in the enterprise. Gentlemen?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Good to hear you.
Good to hear you, too. This is the sound of my voice, obviously, and we just heard from Scott and Ed. So, guys, let's, on this esteemed anniversary, or just the day after the anniversary of World IPv6 launch, which we talked about in gory detail for our last podcast, we can revisit the topic of IPv6 and the levels of adoption that we've seen in the context of enterprises. And we talked a little bit about this last time, but let's go ahead and get like the 10,000 foot view, if we could, from each of you guys, where you think enterprise adoption is with IPv6.
Yeah, I think we can probably agree that it's fairly low. Enterprises have been, their internal networks have been hidden behind their perimeter, firewalls that perform network address translation. They feel like, hey, I don't need IPv6. I have plenty of tenant address space internally. I'll get NATed to /24 that my service provider has provided me, no problems. I don't know what everyone's all worried about.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I don't think enterprise adoption for V6 is particularly substantial by anyone's measure, and certainly they seem to be it seems to be low on the list of things that they want to tackle when I do ask about it. But I think one of the interesting things is that it's starting to become. I think what's happening in the rest of the industry is starting to potentially impact some of the decisions that enterprise folks are starting to make. And so I've had some interesting discussions with some shops around like, hey, we've got some structural problems we're trying to solve, and how do we solve them? I'm like, well, you just adopt IPv6 to get around them.
Yeah, that's right. But if you could hold that thought for 1 second, because I want to come back to that, the structural problems that enterprises are looking at or dealing with that they think, or that you're offering IPv6 as a solution for. And it sounds like you may be getting some traction in terms of getting them to accept that that's a possibility, that they may be able to solve some of those problems going forward. But what is the risk? So if I have, what is the risk to enterprise in not adopting IPv6? So if I have my elevator pitch that I need to make to an enterprise decision maker, what do I say? What are the compelling reasons that I'm going to offer, the strongest leading argument that I'm going to make for why it's important for them to adopt IPv6, and we can talk a little bit, obviously, about what that adoption might look like in the enterprise. And we've spent a lot of time discussing the sort of phased approach to adoption. We'll get into that, but just first, so I'm sitting down with the decision maker at an enterprise, and I need to convince them that it's important that they adopt IPv6. What's my first argument?
I guess, greater flexibility to provide, your end users access to the whole internet. There's more than just, IPv4 reachable sites out there, and there could be NAT avoidance if they use native IPv6. So there could be some performance improvements which improve end user experience. Much of the internet is transitioning to IPv6. And so as that occurs, if they're a technology laggard, they're going to find it slower and slower get places that are more native IPv6. That's one thing.
Yeah, I think from a pure business, if you just switch hats and go from tech to pure business, there are a couple things that are really interesting that are going to sort of cause people to maybe sit up and take notice. And I think those are, is your business planning to innovate around cloud? Are they planning to innovate around IoT and edge? And are they planning on taking security serious? And if they answer yes to any of those, then V6 should fit into the topic set. Now, maybe just a core set of technology or a baseline technology that all those other things are built on top of. And for you to be proficient at those particular ones, you're going to need to have a good understanding of V6, because that's really where those industry sets are going to really end up going, not out of choice, but out of necessity. And so I think that's the interesting side of the business, to understand that it's a core set of technologies that maybe you don't think about every day, but it's going to be something that you really need to have tied in. And I think there's a couple other business use cases that are really interesting. For me, in particular, the merger and acquisition strategy is actually really unique. And I think there's some unique things you can do with V6 in that particular arena that really allow a business to do something that they were incapable of doing before from a M&A standpoint. So if you're a company and an enterprise that's large enough and you're actually doing mergers and acquisitions, you can provide a solution that avoids a lot of both capital and human resource intensive projects to go on that you can just take off the books and not have to do.
So let's get real explicit about that. So we that's a really compelling business case. If I'm looking at having to do mergers and acquisitions, then you've caught my attention with the idea that, hey, look, I can really save money here. I can reduce the risk of this particular merger and acquisition from a business standpoint. But let's jump back over to the technical side. Why is that? What is IPv6 giving me in that scenario of merger and acquisition that I don't already have?
Just greater address space. I mean, yep. Two companies are both using 10-net address space, and it's probably pretty full for most large organizations. And even their private address space may be getting constrained. And as they grow, they deploy intelligent lighting systems, building control, building automation systems, video surveillance, badge readers, the Internet of Things that are in the enterprise network need addresses. You know, as you extend your network in a hybrid IT topology to cloud infrastructure, now you're spinning up different virtual segments, different virtual networks in the cloud, and that can't overlap with the address space internally, or you'd prefer that it not overlap, because if addressing overlaps, then you have to do network address translation or bidirectional network address translation, which then adds administrative overhead to configure those items, adds administrative overhead to troubleshooting end-to-end connectivity, and you only have this one RFC 1918 private address space to work with. So when two companies, you know, Coke and Pepsi merge, then they're both using 10-net address space and there's a conflict. So then they have to do dual, you know, bidirectional NAT to get it to work.
Wait, are you suggesting that two enterprises might be using the same overlapping private address space?
Yes, they all are. I'm sure there's a phone call between company A and company B. Are you using 10.1.1.0/24? Yeah, how'd you know? Are you using 192.168.1/24? Yeah, that's weird. Are you two? You know, there's this weird conversation that they have where they run through all the address space, and it's usually the company that's being acquired that has to readdress.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that Scott brings up, which is there's two sets of costs that are associated with it. Number one is obviously the troubleshooting burden of that, and plus the disaggregation of routing. It actually breaks your routing capabilities natively to be able to do that easily, even if it's redistribution between different routing protocols. But I think more important is I've worked with several enterprises now that have gone through and made an acquisition, right? For company A is a company acquiring company B, and company B was then required to readdress for whatever resources they were doing. In the meantime, they had acquired company C. In addition, so company A acquired company C. Company C had an address range that was in company B that company B was being moved to, and company C says, we can't move that because it's our production facility. And company B has to go back and readdress yet again because they've got a three-way conflict in terms of the address allocation. And so they go back and do that. And then they acquire company D, who has a conflict with something that was hidden company B or company C. And both those teams have to readdress. Mm-hmm. And depending on which executive thinks their project is the most important, determines which team has to go back and readdress within those organizations. Every time you do that, there is zero functional gain and a complete and absolute 100% capital resource waste to do that work. If you choose V6 as a discrete solution and say simply, when we acquire a company, we will hand them a portion of our address block to go ahead and turn up their services and only connect to us with V6. And any V4 they have, they remain the same. We don't change any of that. And any way that they want to interface with us happens with V6. Because you're handing out unique addresses to each one of the acquiring companies, and you own that address space, it is not a problem for you to go ahead and make this a fully workable solution where every acquired company can talk to each other. They can all talk to the acquiring companies, and there's zero conflict or problem. All the routing works natively. You can simply just use specific transition services if you require them for any services that those end companies want to run. But the reality is you would want to port and move those services into your data center anyway. You give them unique address space to go ahead and do that. You can literally shut off you know, those remote data center sites, you don't need them anymore because even their own people are accessing it over v6 back in the internal side. And then it's a choice about how you want to extend that into public cloud, for instance, maybe AWS, and how you want to extend those services out there. But at least you know you have a consistent address range and a consistent global address range that you are going to go ahead and manage on their behalf.
So the effort you would have put into that is actually advancing you towards IPv6, where, you know, the readdressing, you're putting so much resources to changing subnets, changing routing, changing firewall rules, changing DNS. It's not getting you anywhere, and it's distracting you from actually deploying IPv6, which would have actually worked towards solving the problem in the first place.
Yep.
I completely agree with you guys, but let me, from the standpoint of just feigning ignorance, so let's say I'm the same enterprise decision maker, maybe I'm more technical, and everything that you've described to this point makes a lot of sense on paper and at a high level, but then because I don't really know that much about IPv6, I start hearing things that sound suspicious, and maybe, you know, maybe depending on my paranoia based on how long I've been in IT and how many projects I've seen get really complex and fail. And when you start saying things like, okay, this problem of resource allocation in terms of addresses, it just kind of goes away with IPv6. You know, I'm assigning IPv6 address space, and I never have to deal with this issue of renumbering again, or I make the risk of it go way, way down. But maybe I don't believe you. Maybe because I don't know enough about IPv6, I say, well, that sounds really good, but I think we've been here before. And I, you know, so tell me, what is the key bit of information or the key pieces of information that I need to know to give me confidence that what you're saying is true? So when you say, well, I'm going to deploy IPv6 and I'm going to get rid of this overlapping address problem, it's just going to go away entirely, you're not going to have to renumber. Why is that true? Like, so what's the difference between an IPv6 allocation and an IPv4 allocation that makes this true?
Well, I think fundamentally, number one, the size of the address range it affords you the luxury that you never had with either RFC 1918 and IPv4, or even in global, the global address space that's available in IPv4. Even a very minor, small, what we, you know, typically refer to as a site allocation in IPv6, which is a /48, and that's, you know, 48 bits out of the total 128 available. It just gives you an incredible amount of address space and an incredible amount of network space to be able to do some very creative things. And by that function, you simply get the capability to not have to deal with routing propagation problems, the network address translation problems, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. Let me put some numbers around that just so the listeners are clear. So when we talk about a /48, the total number of host addresses available, 1.2 times 10 to the 24th addresses. So obviously playing, you know, sort of devil's advocate, I know the numbers to be able to say, if I've got a /48, which I'm using at one enterprise site, and that's basically the rule of thumb that we use. If I have an enterprise site, I'm going to go ahead and assign an entire /48 to it. So that gives me 1.2 times 10 to the 24th host addresses. But more importantly, from a subnetting standpoint, that gives me 65,000 /64s that I can put on individual interfaces, LAN or WAN interfaces. And each of those in turn has 1.8 times 10 to the 19th host addresses.
Yeah, so, the current V4 internet squared, right?
That's right.
Rough number is a single subnet that we would use for a LAN. We get basically stuff the entire internet and square it and say, like, you know, well, I don't think that there haven't been that many LAN ports actually manufactured.
That's right. We far exceed the number of LAN ports manufactured. But just so that the enterprise decision maker has some numbers to sort of hang around that idea, so that they're credulous. We want them to believe that, look, if you do this planning the right way related to your address space, this problem goes away forever. Not just for the next, you know, quarter, not just for the next fiscal year. You literally dispose of this problem in your organization for the indefinite future, which is a luxury that I don't think we really encounter that often in any IT projects.
Yeah, it's not very often you get to say that, that you get to kill something like that forever. I mean, I don't think there's anything that's really fit in that category. We're still stuck with shops that have tapes. I was just in a enterprise customer's in a meeting with them, and literally the gentleman was rolling up tapes. He's like, I finally pulled these out of Iron Mountain. We've got to destroy them, but they've been hanging around costing us money for the last 11 years.
Yeah, that's right.
I was like, wow. So stuff really sticks around a long time. This is a unique opportunity in terms of using V6 on the enterprise side of really solving this problem once and solving it pretty much for forever.
That's right. And just to beat the dead horse here, because we haven't done that yet. So when I say a slash 48 per site, well, you know, an incredulous listener might be like, well, okay, so I get a slash 48, but I've figured out how to screw up my allocation or assignment of address blocks in the past. And I'm sure I'll figure it out going forward with this one slash 48. But we should be really clear. Our recommendation for enterprises is that they get a slash 32 of IPv6 address space, which gives them 65,536 slash 48s to assign. So right. it's really rather foolproof, you know, with the proviso that the old saying is that they'll always build a better fool. But, you know, if you give an enterprise a slash 32, you really do have the opportunity to put this resource issue to bed forever.
Yeah. I mean, every network guy should be excited about this, because this really is routing is routing. Like, we get to go back to being like router jockeys as opposed to like crazy NAT fools that are trying to figure out how to do weird things with devices we probably never wanted to work on anyway.
That's right.
At least that's my opinion. I don't know. I do think this actually offers some unique capabilities for even folks who are trying to do interesting things with security too, because we were never given the luxury of being able to basically have what I consider like disposable network ranges that are just like, hey, we need to do specific things for these services. We were always doing weird like bit nibble sort of configurations of V4 and hoping that we got something that looked close to right, or, you know, squeeze it in there, and you always had like two extra hosts past what you needed, and you're like, how do I write the security policy to include all, and then you just get rid of all that. You don't have to deal with it anymore.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the issues when an organization, a large enterprise, gets such a large IPv6 allocation, their temptation is to do addressing and create all these artificial levels of hierarchy. They have all this space and they don't know what to do with it. So they're like, we must fill it. We must have some grand universal theory of how all this is going to be laid out for the foreseeable, you know, predictable future, you know, with flying cars. And, you know, they're thinking far ahead. And you're like, no, you know, just focus on what you have to do now. And you'll have plenty of address space to grow as your needs grow.
Right.
But you're right. I know a good book on this subject too, right, Tom? that I would recommend to enterprises who are thinking of creating an addressing plan, a good O'Reilly book that Tom wrote years ago. But when you shift from changing your addressing from the minimum amount for the, you know, the minimum size required for the number of nodes, you know, and Ed, you talked about, you know, slicing and dicing up very small subnets, you know, slash 29 here, and I'm going to use a slash 28 here, and I'm going to create this other VLAN for this security thing, and I'm going to put my PCI data here, and it's going to be small because that's all I have. Well, you change with IPv6 from addressing for minimum host allocation to ease of management and also ease of security. You know, I want to create overlays. I want to create enclaves. I want to create segmentation. I want to create AWS VPCs. I want to break all this up and then control access and create the orbital security model. I want to create a nested model, you know, based on trust. And you can do that with IPv6.
And easily. I think that's the part that's missed. I mean, you can do this with V4, but you spend... And maybe the folks that really enjoy this and want to spend all the detail and time because it's a challenge, but V6 is just not a big of a challenge. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe we're not masochistic enough. We don't want to do that work. But I look at it and I go, wow, V6 is a lot easier in terms of the at scale design and the flexibility. And Tom and I have talked about this, you know, in relation to his book, that it's hard for people to give up. Like, certain aspects of addressing where they're just like, oh, we have to get down to the detail. I'm like, no details. Hand that off to someone else. They can work on the details for that, you know, specific site local configuration. Just hand them a block of addresses and say, it's yours.
Yeah.
And slash 64, go. Oh, that's not big enough for you? Slash 48, go.
That's right.
Here's another one.
And if that's not big enough for you, slash 32, go. Because again, we just continue to increase the size of the allocation that we can get from a regional internet registry. And they are, their stated policy is to provide you the address resources that you need for your particular architecture. And they don't care what the details are. If you tell them this is what I need, then that's what they provide based on their willingness to assume that you know your job and building your network and what your network should look like better than they do. And that was really, I think, the initial goal, perhaps, with IPv4, without the sufficient number of bits.
You know, there's been some well-established standard, you know, path forward for enterprises. You know, if they agree that, yeah, they're running out of private address space, yeah, they need more addressing to further innovation, you know, there's a standard path forward that, you know, many enterprises such as the U.S. federal government have followed, which is kind of get trained, get a plan, you build your addressing plan, go get your addressing resources, do some little proof of concepts and start at the internet perimeter. That's where you connect to the internet. And that's where, you know, beyond just mergers and acquisitions, it's about having a native address space, a global address space to communicate with partners, suppliers, customers, vendors, everybody, you know, you want to communicate with, and it's over a network. Once you start at the internet edge, then you start to bring it down further into your organization, you know, one step at a time, and then get it to the end users probably first, because they're going to benefit from dual protocol internet connectivity. So that's a pretty standard method of how enterprises should start.
Well, let's pivot on that a little bit. And I know there's been some with the launch yesterday. I saw ISOC had released out some reports. I think a few other folks had released out some interesting reports. And I think that's something that maybe our users would be interested in going and checking out. So ISOC released their sort of state of the internet report, I guess is a better way to put it, versus just purely something about IPv6. It was really probably more encompassing than that. And then I know Scott and Tom and myself a little bit worked on a report that came out from Hexabuild that was sort of a IPv6 adoption report that folks can check out. And I think that was pretty neat. You can just hit up on Twitter and check out this sort of the IPv6, search for that in a report, and you should be able to pull up most of the links. But there's some good information out there today from a whole slew of folks. I think Aaron and Ripe have both released stuff out also. For people to sort of get an understanding about where things are at from the internet overall, which really helps explain why enterprises need to be moving to V6, because just to be able to interface and talk with the rest of the true internet, right? V4 and V6 internet, you know, understanding what's happening in those ecosystems is really important.
That's right. And as part of that sort of celebration of World IPv6 launch, which just so listeners, if they're not familiar with it, if they sort of missed all the hubbub yesterday, you can check out the World IPv6 launch.org site. You know, it's just sort of that's sort of the homepage for that effort. And you can sort of see the massive amount of growth. There's a lot of activity on Twitter that talked about it yesterday as well. But what's really critical about that is that there's definitely this sense that we've seen incredible adoption levels among service providers and among content providers, but we still see that enterprises are lagging very far behind. And as part of an infographic that we put together, right, was the statistic that, you know, you can look at things like 1 in 5 households in the U.S. Are IPv6 enabled. 1 in 2 websites, depending on how you slice and dice the data, but say the top, you know, Alexa top 100. You can get 1 in 2, the statistic of 1 in 2 websites enabled for IPv6. And then you get down to the enterprise desktop and it's, I'm sorry, I skipped the probably the most impressive one, which is mobile devices. 7 out of 10 mobile devices are enabled for IPv6 here in the U.S. These are U.S. statistics, by the way. And then finally, 1 in 7,000 desktops in the enterprise is enabled?
Yeah,
purposely and consciously enabled for IPv6 connectivity. To actually go out and connect to the IPv6 internet. So, I mean, that just really shows you the vast gulf between where everything else is in terms of internet and networking technology and deployment of IPv6 and service providers and content providers versus where enterprises are at and the tremendous sort of distance that needs to be made up in that area.
Yep, couldn't agree more. Well, I don't know. Is that a wrap for us on this one?
I think so. We've covered some good territory. Scott, anything else to add?
No, yeah, it's pretty bleak when it comes to IPv6 use on enterprise desktops in the office.
We leave you in the desert. That's how we wrap up. We're going to leave you in the desert of enterprise V6 adoption.
That's right. With a call to action for enterprise decision makers, right, and enterprise tech folk. you know, really check out some of the resources that are available that we mentioned on during this podcast, and know that, you know, it's okay to, as Ron Bresma so famously put it from, you know, DRAN, the big government enterprise network, where he's like, don't be afraid to break things. Don't be afraid to break some glass where IPv6 is concerned. And as we're always fond of pointing out, you know, you're already running it. It's already deployed by default with all of your modern operating systems on and preferred by default. You're just, you know, it's typically just not being managed. And in the case of enterprises, we just mentioned, not actually plumbed out to the IPv6 internet. But again, don't be afraid to get your hands dirty. If you're an enterprise just getting started, you can make incredible substantive gains in getting it deployed much sooner than you would have expected. That's our guarantee to you here at the IPv6 Buzz podcast.
Well, very cool.
All right, guys. Thanks again. And our listeners, thanks so much for checking out the IPv6 Buzz podcast. Everyone, have a great rest of your week, and tune in again.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.